Please call the case.
Case number SCWC-30644, Lahaina Fashions, Inc. v. Bank of Hawaii. Arguing for the petitioner, Joseph Alioto. Also appearing for the petitioner, James Dombrowski. Arguing for the respondent, Andrew Lautenbach. Argument on the merits.
Good morning, counsel. Mr. Alioto, my understanding is that you have reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And Mr. Lautenbach, you'd like a five-minute warning, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Very good. Mr. Alioto, you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Joseph M. Alioto. I appear before the court pro hac vice, as I appear before the Court of Appeals and the trial court. The issues arise out of a case that was tried for 8 weeks, which the jury returned a unanimous verdict with regard to the liability and the damages, and also finding that the bank acted maliciously and oppressively against these plaintiffs and awarded punitive damages. When it came to the question of the statute of limitations, they answered it in a question of no. They answered it yes. Subsequently, it was determined that that answer was incorrect. And it was obviously incorrect when the judge brought 2 months later, held the jury in abeyance, had originally discharged them, brought them back in a few minutes, again rescinded the order of discharge, told them they were under the control of the court, they could not discuss it with anyone, and told them that they would be returning within 2 months. They returned within 2 months, and the judge at that time questioned each of the jurors separately and apart, and specifically asked them whether or not the verdict that was read to them was correct. At least seven, perhaps eight, said that it was their verdict, except for the last question. And the last question should have been answered no instead of yes. One of the jurors even said, we never would have done what we did if we thought that the statute had run. That question was not, it was obvious, it was an obvious mistake, it was a clear mistake. The court would not allow us to make any inquiries with regard to any of that. Subsequently, the Court of Appeals, ICA, determined that the jury was never, was discharged, and that was the end of it, and therefore they could not give evidence to show that they had made an innocent mistake, an innocent and obvious mistake. There was nobody in the trial court. And there was nobody in the Court of Appeals, and I submit there's nobody here who doesn't realize that this was a mistake and that the jurors basically said so. And so the issue is presented as to whether or not the court's going to be able to, or this court is going to be able to say that it's the policy of the state of Hawaii that you attempt to uphold the jury verdicts. And when there's an obvious mistake, you can correct them. We have submitted a substantial body of law that shows that in situations like that, the courts will not hesitate to do just that. Indeed, the cases that we have shown to you are far more intricate than this very simple situation. Our verdict form, if you saw it and it's part of the record, it just goes straight down and they answered yes all the way down, and even including the last one, which for the first time was the longest question, of course, and turned into a double negative. But when they realized what that was and that was not, in fact, their verdict, they gave that testimony under oath. We were not allowed to question the jurors as each one of them was questioned separately and apart. In addition, the defendant did not at that time, and remember, this was an affirmative defense. So the case had already been presented, already been proven, and that it was very clear that the bank in this particular situation not only interfered with the business advantage of the plaintiffs, all of whom were in their 70s or 80s, but that they outright lied to them, failed to disclose to them, and they did it on purpose for them, and did it while they had a fiduciary relationship. And then subsequently, the jury found all of that.
What does the fiduciary relationship arise out of?
Pardon me?
From what does the fiduciary relationship arise out of?
Out of the option, Your Honor.
And why is that?
It arises out of the option because this was defendant bank wanted to buy the property. They submitted a proposal to the plaintiff. The plaintiff that day said, okay, I will sell it for $6 million, but if I can, to you, but if I can sell it to somebody else up to $9 million, I get the extra $3 million, and then after that, we'll split 50-50. Mr. Weir, that day, the bank, that day, agreed to that, and therefore, they were holding that property in a fiduciary relationship with regard to that option. During the time, as the evidence showed, they got plenty of offers to buy it for more than six, but less than nine, which they did not tell the plaintiff about.
Is it your contention that this fiduciary relationship is separate from the, in other words, that I guess that's paragraph 10 of the lease. Is it a separate sort, or are you saying that there's a fiduciary relationship that is inclusive not only of paragraph 10, but as all terms of the lease?
Yes. And even Mr. Weir, who was the executive vice president.
I asked you either or, and you said yes. I'm sorry, what was the answer to my question?
Oh, I didn't understand that it was either or. The situation was this. The bank had organized a separate group that invested in real estate. And they had a fiduciary relationship to the people who were investing in that relationship. And they were promising them that the basis of the investment was appreciation of the land that they were buying.
My question is different. My question is, was there a fiduciary relationship that fully encompassed the lease, or is your argument that, in fact, the fiduciary relationship arises just out of Section 10 of the lease, which is, creates this tenant's option to purchase?
It was the option, because they were holding the property, and we were the ones who had the right under the option. And they were holding that for our benefit if we were able to sell it.
Now, this is a pretty unusual tenant option to purchase, is it not? In the sense that what seems to me a little bit unusual in this case is that normally when a tenant leases property, they're not given the right to sell the landlord's property. Isn't that pretty unusual?
Whether it is unusual or not, Your Honor, I cannot address that. All I know is that my client demanded these particular provisions and the bank accepted it that day.
Well, let me just go on, because what happens, it looks like to me, is if in fact the tenant is able to find a buyer, the tenant is able to require the landlord not only to give up the interest in the leasehold, the new owner has to give that up, and has to give up his interest in the fee, and the tenant has to give up all their interest, and it all ends up in some third party.
It's not really a tenant-landlord case, Your Honor. They sold it, and so it's a buyer-seller. And the seller sold it to the bank for $6 million, but on the condition that if he were able to get a higher price, that then he would get all the money over $6 million to himself for $3 million of it.
What if there had been an offer for $9.5 million, but the bank wanted $10? Would the bank still have been obligated to sign off on the purchase?
Mr. Takauchi could have accepted it. He had the right to be able to sell it if he could sell it for more. If he sold it for $9.5 million, he would get his $6 million, the bank would get their $6 million back, he would get $3 million, and they would split the 50-50. The bank made a bad deal, but that wasn't their intent. Their intent was to get that property and put it in this holding for all these other investors, advising them, not correctly, that they were going to be able to appreciate the land. And so they withheld that information from those investors. And when they received offers that in fact appreciated the land and made it, and people were going to buy it for more than the $6 million, they did not tell Mr. Takauchi about it. And instead, they began to use legal processes against him. So he and his sister at that time, they were about 75 or 78 at that time, I forget.
Didn't the $8 million offer come in after they had commenced to terminate the lease?
They commenced the action to terminate the option, knowing
to terminate the lease. Terminating their leasehold interest is what they They didn't, the option was just part of it. They commenced action because your client was behind in rent.
The actions that were taken against Mr. Takeuchi and Lahaina Fashions were done during the time that they knew that they had available and ability to sell the property, but they wouldn't be able to sell it for more than $9 million. And they withheld that information. And instead, they began to file lawsuits against him. And the whole purpose of that was to deprive him of the option and to extinguish the option. And they knew at the time that they did it that there were offers and that they could easily have converted this property into money, but it was less than what it made, where it made difference to them. And remember, the bank had already represented to all of its investors that these investments were for appreciation, and they didn't tell them that, well, in this case there was an option, and even if it did appreciate, you're not going to get it. The jury found, as a fact, not only did they interfere, but they did so maliciously and oppressively. They did it on purpose against these people. Now, they went right down the line with that. There was no issue with regard to that for this jury. The jury awarded punitive damages in the amount of 1%, I believe, of the equity of the bank, which at that time was $770,000.
Now, your assertion is that the bank had a fiduciary obligation to you, or relationship. Did you also have a fiduciary obligation to the bank?
To whom?
To the bank as a result.
We were not holding property for the benefit of the bank.
The bank
was holding property for our benefit.
But what if you, wouldn't you still have a duty to, let's say, you know, you got an offer for $9.5 million, but you knew that they would gladly pay $10 million, which would give the bank $500,000 instead of $250,000. Are you saying you would have no duty?
No duty to the bank to advise them about it?
Yes.
Of course, we were advising them about anything we ever got.
So there
we had no problem.
So there's mutual fiduciary responsibility. I mean, you couldn't sell it to a relative. There was all kinds of things that you couldn't do.
I think here the real point was, Your Honor, when Mr. Weir, who happens, by the way, contrary to what the ICA said, happens to be an attorney in Hawaii and an attorney in California. He happens to be the executive vice president of the bank. He wrote a paper and delivered comments on a paper on how you can defeat liability, how a fiduciary can defeat liability. On the stand, he had the temerity, in my judgment, he had the temerity to say, well, we owed a fiduciary duty to our investors. And to Mr. Takeuchi, he finally had to admit he owed a fiduciary, but he said it's a small F. So a big F to these investors and a small F. So the Bank of Hawaii thinks that they have two different kinds of fiduciary obligation, the only people in the world, a big F and a small F. Now that's in the testimony, and that kind of evidence from a distinguished, powerful person in regard to the very thing that he seems to be expert on, and admitting that particular situation, and the ICA simply said, well, that was a lay opinion, and it didn't make any difference, and the judge was right in throwing the case out on the ground of lack of, no, there was no fiduciary relationship.
What's your position?
With the interference with a prospective business relationship, that claim would be separate from any trust relationship.
Yes, Your Honor.
And so what was the specific trust relationship in this transaction?
The bank was holding, the bank had bought the property. However, because of the option, they were holding it for our benefit should someone come in and seek to purchase the property for more than the $6 million that was paid to Mr. Takeuchi from the bank. So if someone came in, they were holding the property, and it was a 10-year situation, and they, as we showed in the evidence, they knew from the beginning, they had no intention of selling that property for the 10 years, period, no matter what happened. And the evidence showed that when they got all these offers, they never told them about it. And they didn't want to tell them about it because that's the last thing they wanted to do because they made a bad deal. But they made a bad deal because they did it all in one day, and they wanted to do it because the property was one of the best pieces of property in Lahaina. Very famous, obviously, very famous place, but a very famous piece of property right in the middle of Lahaina. and a very important piece of property, and one that was in the Takeuchi family for many, many years. So they owed to them that they were holding this property, and if these offers came up, then of course it would be to the benefit of the plaintiffs. And they did come up, but they didn't tell them about it. So they failed to disclose it.
You folks are almost like partners, or it's a joint venture, it seems to me, when you, the way this deal was worked out.
Ordinarily, when you have partners and you have joint ventures, you expect that the other person is going to tell you what's going on and not hide things from you and not fail to disclose things to you that are pertinent and material. And as a matter of fact, Mr. Weir used the example of a husband and wife as the very same kind of fiduciary relationship that existed between him and Mr. Takeuchi.
You said very little in your application about the fiduciary relationship. So what specifically did the ICA do that was wrong?
ICA affirmed the decision by the trial court to dismiss the fiduciary relationship issue. And it did so on the ground that, notwithstanding the extraordinary admissions by the executive vice president and the writer of the article, the name of which is "Can Fiduciaries Avoid Liability Under Law?" Well, this guy certainly did. And the ICA determined that this person was simply a lay person, and therefore that testimony, which was not objected, somehow should not have been admissible, and therefore there was no basis for any fiduciary claim.
Wasn't he an agent of the party?
Pardon me?
The person who testified to that, wasn't he an agent of a party?
Absolutely. He was the executive vice president of the bank.
So why would there be a distinction? If it's an admission, it comes in regardless if it's in a lay or expert opinion.
Either way, Your Honor, I agree. Either way, but the court said no. Both the courts. And the way the ICA dismissed it was that this was a layperson, and therefore it's not admissible. That's what the court said.
Well, as a practical matter, I mean, not just as a practical matter, but as a matter of law, in this jurisdiction, even if the parties stipulate as to the law, that would not be binding on the court. So even if the parties in this case had stipulated that there was a fiduciary relationship, that would not have been binding on this court as to whether or not there was a fiduciary relationship as a matter of law. However, let's talk about what is a fiduciary duty. And when you look at Section 874 of the Restatement Second of Torts, it does say that a fiduciary relation exists between two persons when one of them is under a duty to act for or to give advice for the benefit of another upon matters within the scope of the relation. See Restatement Second Trust, Section 2. Restatement Section Trust, Section 2 says, a trust is a fiduciary relationship with respect to property, subjecting the person by whom the property is held to equitable duties to deal with the property for the benefit of another person, which arises as a result of the manifestation of an intention to create it. So would there be some arguments as to whether or not there's questions of fact as to whether or not the two parties in this case were in a fiduciary relationship to each other?
Yes, we were only developing the evidence, Your Honor, and we were only developing the facts. We're not saying that this person can give the law. But he can give facts, and he can admit it, and he can at least show his intent as to what he was doing, and he happened to be in charge of all these real estate investments. We cited the, as the court knows, we cited K.O. Hanoan on page, at least on page 12. Mm-hmm. And I think that is very, they're very specific. The idea was that the court would instruct the jury on what it meant to have a fiduciary relationship, and then we would have argued the evidence as to what they said.
In this case, the parties had equitable duties to each other.
Yes, Your Honor. And just so that I do want to be clear about one thing. We never took the position that there are two different, there's big F and little F. That was, in all due respect, that was an arrogant statement of of obvious power, and he knew exactly what the problem was. He was a lawyer, and he knew he was in trouble, and he just simply didn't want to say that he owed a fiduciary relationship to these people that was in any way similar to the one that he owed to his investors. And getting back to the, I guess the crux of the matter was, or the crux of the case, is that in addition to that, is whether or not the obvious mistake, whether the court's going to take a view that that mistake can be corrected. And the idea that a jury cannot make a mistake or a judge could not make a mistake is obviously, it's in our law that is there are provisions for it, as this court is well aware, both in Rule 606 and in Rule 60.
The now, problem is, though, that this Hawaii has not adopted the amendments that the federal rules of evidence have adopted under Rule 606B, and which I don't have the rule in front of me, but 606B under the federal rules now clearly state that you can correct mistakes in the verdict can be corrected, but we did not adopt that.
It is correct that that in 606, the part of the federal statute says that a mistake, that would be 606B2C, says a mistake was made in entering the verdict on the verdict form, allowing the jurors to testify to that. Okay. The court says that this court has not adopted that. But this court has said, do you see the Supreme Court decisions that we gave to you from this very court? And where that situation exists, the court is not unwilling to correct an obvious mistake.
Have we ever said if you misunderstand a question and you respond exactly in the way you misunderstand it, that that's going to be reversible?
I don't know that it's a misunderstanding, Your Honor. I think it's more like this. I think what it seems to me from what the jurors said, there was never any misunderstanding. The foreman apparently not checked the yes when it meant no. And the question was, with regard to statute of limitations, and each of them voluntarily, and remember, the court had taken them out separately, one at a time. Nobody was there each time each juror was questioned 2 months later.
Excuse me, is your argument now that the foreperson mismarked it and it didn't reflect what the jury told him? I don't remember.
We don't know. We wanted to inquire. We don't know how it happened. We know that the foreman was the one who marked the verdict form. That's what we know. And we know that the people said, no, that is not my verdict. My verdict was, and they would go specifically to that question.
Well, they said that only after the judge went out and talked to them about the consequence of their answer to question 7.
We do not know precisely, Your Honor, what the judge did.
Right, except you have the jurors saying, after you talked to us, then we realize our answer should have been different, or something to that effect.
That is true, and that happens in a number of the cases that we have shown the court. But we had to go one step further because we wanted to know. So we asked to take the deposition of the judge, a very extraordinary request, and it was heard by another judge. And that was denied. And they were using.
Let me ask you one thing. The court relied on the Cabral case.
Yes.
And Cabral says when special interrogatories are posed to the jury, then what we look at is whether or not, what we look at is their answers to the questions. And so whether the jury intended something or whether they intended, what the ultimate result turns out to be is not really an issue, because the ultimate result is the one drawn by the court from the answers to the questions. So isn't that this situation?
No, for two reasons. First of all, Cabal was far more intricate, but the jury was discharged in Cabal. In our case, the judge called him back in and said, you are not discharged. I am rescinding that. You can't talk to anybody. We still have not been able to talk to them. They were not discharged. They were in the possession of the judge.
Well, assuming they were not discharged, Cabral would still apply, would it not?
No.
If they were not discharged?
No, because we showed the court the cases where it says that that is a difference. And in Cabal, they made specific note, they made specific notation that they, that it was discharged. And the Duke case and others said that that was a different, that was a difference. And so what the court here in ICA, said they were discharged and it was never rescinded, even though the judge rescinded it specifically. And what the judge, when he rescinded it, I guess didn't count. And therefore, we're not even going to look at these jurors advising us that they made a mistake.
Let me ask you this question. During deliberation, didn't the jury send out a question that if they find fault and award damages, can they find fault and award damages even if they feel the statute of limitations passed? Did they send out that interrogatory?
I'll have to say that I do not remember that.
Oh, okay. Assuming that they did, wouldn't that indicate that they did understand what the basic issue was with respect to the statute of limitations?
I'm sure that the jury understood that there was a statute of limitation issue. And when they came in and were separately questioned, they said the statue was still alive. And I guess they saw it in an affirmative way instead of a negative way. And they said, yes, the statute is still alive. And at least three of them you'd see in their testimony, they were saying, yes, it still exists. Yes, this, yes, that.
But they kept
but
saying,
the answer had to be no.
But they kept saying, one after another, they misunderstood the way the special interrogatory was phrased. They misinterpreted. One after another, juror 2, juror 7, juror 9, juror 8, they all said they misunderstood the question. Are we to go back every time there's a verdict and ask the jurors what their understanding was of the question if one of the parties don't like the verdict?
When you have a situation, it's not a question of liking or disliking the verdict, Your Honor. And these inquiries, it's obvious that the courts provide in the various statutes, the courts are not naive that people are going to make mistakes. And if a mistake, even for a verdict in Rule 60, you can always come back if there's a mistake. And here there was a mistake. They understood that the statute of limitations, they didn't think it ran. And here's the thing, this is an affirmative defense. This is an affirmative defense. We don't have to prove that. It was their obligation. Okay, they got lucky. You know, they didn't do the right thing. They know that it was wrong. So they're precedent. They didn't ask for a new trial. They didn't,
Did you folks ask for a new trial?
We didn't ask for a new trial because the jurors were all saying that they made a mistake. What we did ask, that the judge did not allow us, is reconvene the jury. And we will argue just this. And even though it was 2 months later, reconvene the jury. And that's what most of the judges do. And that's the instruction, like, for instance, in the Sixth Circuit, also in the Second Circuit, and even in this court. This court also treated it, and we cited the case for you. And that's ordinarily what would happen. But the judge did not want to do that.
Mr. Alioto, what is the significance of the fact that the judge talked to the jury without counsel present? As ICA mentioned that was a problem.
The ICA said that was improper. I don't know. I mean, in my experience, that I've been doing this for about 45 years. And I understand that the judges generally go back and they talk to the jury after the trial.
I in no way meant to say that wasn't proper. That, of course, was proper. But, I mean, how can you say the jury was not discharged? If the jury had not been discharged, then would that have been a problem?
But we gave you the case in which the very same thing happened and there was no issue with regard to it, and I believe it was the Sixth Circuit case. And the judge went back. Sometimes the jury would say, wait a minute, or even talking to an attaché or something like that. And so all of a sudden that is supposed to be avoided. The judge went back, I think it's the Seventh Circuit case, I'm not sure which one, Seventh or Sixth Circuit case, judge did exactly the same thing. In another one, a juror said, oh, well, this guy will get this or that. No, he's not going to get it because of something else. That's wrong. Judge still had the power over the jury. Your Honor, that's the most important part. The judge had the power over the jury.
But did the judge actually have the power over the jury? The jury, once the jury is discharged, There are many situations which some jurors don't stay around to talk to the judge and actually leave. So, in this case, they were still there. But we actually don't know if the jurors spoke to even others before the judge came in, do we?
Talk to others?
Right.
As far as we know, they did not. They were in the jury room, and he told them to stay where they were, as we understand it. He then advised us. We were advised. We came to the courthouse. He recalled the jury, and he specifically said, I'm rescinding that instruction, the discharge. I'm rescinding it. So it was under the control of the court, which is one of the issues. And there was no tainting. There was no opportunity to be tainted by any outside influence. And he gave the same instruction when he dismissed them and then said he would call them back and took the testimony of each one separately.
Isn't this a case where the jurors answered the questions and there was no mistake in how they answered the specific question, but that when they found out what the consequences of their answer was, then they felt they had not answered it the way they wanted to answer?
No, Your Honor. It's not the consequences that they found out. What they found out is that they plugged in the wrong answer. It's not the consequences.
Well, the consequence of their answer, I guess, indicated to them that that was not maybe what they intended.
No, it's not like these other cases where they're doing percentages of personal injury, negligence, and things like that, and then they find out later, well, you said one thing, but the consequence of that is something else. Oh, well, then we're going to change some figures or do something like that, which these other cases are like. No, it's not. They were never inquired as to why they were doing what they were doing or why this. What they were asked, what did you do? And they believed and said that they thought they voted that the statute had not run. You can say, okay, well, the consequence of that is this. But they're not saying, oh, wait a minute. We agreed that this is the answer we should have gone, but if the consequences were something else, oh, well, then we want to change it. No. They just said the answer we gave was wrong. And we would respectfully submit. This court has the power. Hawaii has the power. I think it was very wrong for the ICA to say that this upholds the integrity of the jury, and this encourages people to believe in the judicial system. I think it goes exactly the opposite. And I know that this court can change it. And it's our position that we hope that you will. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Good morning. My name is Andrew Lautenbach. I represent the respondents in this matter, Bank of Hawaii, Hawaiian Trust Company, Pacific Century Trust, and the Hawaii Real Estate Equity Fund. May it please the court. Policy considerations at issue in this case are very significant. Any ruling that would adopt Lahaina Fashion's position would completely undermine the founding tenets of Hawaii's judicial system, including the sanctity of the jury as an independent body that needs to be kept free from outside influence, the need for stability, the finality in jury verdicts.
In your opinion, where was the, at what point was, do you think that this jury was still within the control of the judge?
No, Your Honor.
Why?
The jury had been discharged and the verdict had been entered on the record without objection.
What if the jury was still in the courtroom? Is it the fact that the judge said you are discharged? Is that the line that you think we should draw?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor.
So if the judge mistakenly says, oh, you're discharged, oh, wait, that's, the judge can't retract it at that point?
Your Honor, the jury's function ceases upon entry of the verdict.
Entry of the verdict onto the record. The verdict had not been filed yet, correct? I mean, it's the clerks don't usually just file stamp it and file it in open court. They usually go back to the chambers later and file it.
The judge expressly stated here that the verdict would be accepted.
Accepted.
The record. And there was no objection. There was no indication of any inconsistency on the verdict form. There was no defect that was risen by any party as to why the verdict should not be accepted. At that point, the jury's function was complete. And following that, when the judge said, you're discharged, they no longer existed as a legal entity that was...
Well, what if after the judge said you're discharged, counsel said, wait, judge, may we approach? We realize that there's an inconsistency here. Are you saying that the judge, even if the jury was still in the courtroom, would not have the power or the authority to set aside that discharge?
Your Honor, I believe that that would be a proper rule for Hawaii. It would provide trial courts with a bright line as to when a verdict can be resubmitted to the jury for further deliberations.
So what is the line then?
Is that going back to Justice McKenna, you're saying that's the line, but is that a rational, efficient way that just because you're 1 second too late that you realize that there's an inconsistency or your bailiff comes up to you, which has occurred for me right afterwards and says something to you, and then all of a sudden you realize there may be a potential problem. You can't say, oh, wait a minute, I know I discharged you, but I'm taking that back. Go into the jury room, wait, I'll be with you, and that's not okay?
I believe that there are plenty of opportunities prior to the statement that a jury is discharged for counsel to raise any inconsistencies in the record. There's a polling.
Could you, if we don't adopt that position, could you fashion an alternate test other than the judge saying the jury is discharged?
Certainly, Your Honor. And respectfully, under any test, the jury here could not be reconvened. The test could be when the jury leaves the courtroom, could be when they leave the courthouse, it could be even like the State versus Rodriguez case out of New Mexico. It could be where jurors are, where the judge makes a finding that they were subject to some outside improper influence.
We know in this case that the judge spoke to the jurors.
Right.
Was there any record developed as to whether or not potentially the jurors may have spoken to others, including the bailiff, including perhaps the bailiff? Was there any record as to whether or not the jurors had received their cell phones back and had spoken to other people? Was there any record of that nature developed in this case?
No record was made in that regard.
Counsel, at one point, the plaintiffs moved to resubmit the case to the jury. Now, did they have alternative requests other than resubmitting the case to the jury?
Did they make alternative requests?
Alternative requests.
Immediately following the August 7th colloquy, Lahaina Fashions moved for a correction of the verdict under Rule 60.
Okay.
The motion to resubmit the verdict to the jurors came in April of 2010, which was some 10 months after the verdict had been read into the record.
So prior to that, they asked that the verdict be corrected by, I guess, what, striking the answer to number 7 and entering judgment on behalf of the plaintiffs?
That's correct.
That's correct.
Let me ask you something. This may not have occurred in this trial, but in our criminal trials now, what we do with our alternates is just before we send the jury back for deliberation, we release the alternates, but don't discharge them in the case we have to bring them back in case one of the jurors gets sick. So even if the judge were to discharge the jurors in front of them, it wouldn't even be a complete discharge because we don't discharge that other juror that we've released until later in any event.
In this case, my recollection is that the alternates were released. I don't recall whether they were discharged, but they were released prior to deliberations. I guess I would question then when those alternates become discharged.
I think that's the point. I think this hard and fast rule may not work with all the circumstances that you're advocating.
Well, I believe that the rule as to alternates would be the same as it is to any the rest of the jury. Once the jury is discharged, they cannot be reconvened to continue their deliberations. Now, there is a legitimate question here as to where you draw that line, and I recognize that there are considerations on both sides as to whether there's a reason for a hard and fast rule, which is what the ICA determined, or a more flexible rule. Frankly, the underlying judgment here needs to be affirmed regardless of where you draw that line. I think that the ICA's decision was correct in that, as I was saying earlier, a bright line will provide clarity for trial judges. It eliminates any risk of verdicts being resubmitted to jurors after they've been tainted, and it eliminates the need for judges to make a subjective determination as to whether or not there may have been some outside influence, returning your cell phone, speaking with a bailiff.
Well, clearly, in this case, I don't think it could be resubmitted, but how were you entitled to JMOL on the trust issue?
Your Honor, the question about fiduciary duty and whether that duty exists is a question of law. The trial court had to make a determination one way or the other as a matter of law. There was certainly no question of fact as to whether that duty existed. In making that determination...
Why not no question of fact? He says, Mr. Aliodo says, there is a question of fact. But the jury never even got to decide this issue.
The question of fact would be whether or not the duty was breached if a duty had existed. Before you can get to that question of fact, there needs to be a determination that there is, in fact, a duty to be breached.
Right. So isn't there a question of fact as to whether or not there was a duty?
Respectfully, no, Your Honor. There was a question of law as to whether there was a duty. If the trial court had found that there was a duty, there would be then a question of fact as to whether there
was there any duty for the parties to act for the benefit of the other within the scope of the option agreement?
Your Honor, there was a contractual duty, and inherent in that contractual duty is the duty of good faith and fair dealing, and both parties were obligated to act pursuant to that contractual duty and to act in good faith. There's no question about that.
Okay, so then if there was such a duty, then... Sorry, now you're seems like you're conceding that there's potentially a duty here.
A contractual duty needs to be distinguished from a fiduciary duty.
A fiduciary duty exists between partners. A partnership agreement, that's a contractual relationship. There's a fiduciary duty between joint venturers. Aren't there at least questions of fact as to whether or not this is a potential joint venture as to the option agreement? A prospective joint venture?
First, there was never an allegation or assertion by any party that this was a joint venture. This was, by all accounts, an arm's length commercial transaction. It was the sale and lease back of a commercial property, a multi-million dollar commercial property.
I'm not talking about the sale and lease back. I'm talking about the option.
The option was, at its core, a contract to convey a piece of property. The restatement is clear that...
But this is not a simple option. This is a somewhat unusual option. I don't think I've ever seen an option like this, where it says, you know, I'll pay you back what you paid for the property, but if I get $3 million or more, I get to keep that. But then anything in excess of that $9 million, we're going to split it 50-50.
With the exception of the sharing of the proceeds, I don't see this as being that unusual.
You were giving up your leasehold interest. You were giving up your fee interest. The tenant was giving up their leasehold interest. Everybody was giving up what they had involved with the joint purpose of selling this to a third party so both parties could make money on this thing. That looks like, to me, something resembling a joint venture, a prospective joint venture.
Your Honor, the nature of any commercial option is for the parties to enter into a contractual relationship which is mutually beneficial economically as to both parties. We received consideration for providing that option in the form of lease rent at 8% on a $6 million purchase. That's $480,000 a year that we received for each year that this lease continued. And the option did nothing more than create an opportunity for Lahaina Fashions to resell this property. And if it was resold at a minimum, my clients would receive back what they put into this deal, which was $6 million, and then they had an opportunity for additional appreciation if there was a sale overnight.
But if your clients were able to terminate the lease because the option was tied to the 50-year lease, and if your client was able to, as you were able to, terminate the lease, then you don't even have to give up. Did you have to give up the $6 million? Would you have been able to, if Lahaina Fashions hadn't filed for bankruptcy and the sale wasn't approved through bankruptcy, if that termination, the judgment for possession, stayed in effect, wouldn't your client have gotten the first $6 million too?
Your Honor, when the lease was terminated, the option was also terminated.
Right.
We had already paid the $6 million to Lahaina Fashions back in 1994. We don't get that money back unless there's an exercise of the option.
Okay.
So we gave up that money.
Okay.
We bought the property, we bought the fee, and we paid good consideration for that. The lease.
But they did get an offer for more than, six.
And you're absolutely correct that the option was a part of the lease.
Was in your client's interest to terminate the lease.
At the point that we filed the summary possession action, the tenant, Lahaina Fashions, had defaulted on its lease rent, which, as I stated, was $480,000 per year.
Did Lahaina Fashions introduce evidence in opposition suggesting that for similar tenants, your client had a practice of trying to work things out instead of immediately going into eviction?
Larry Johnson testified that, yes, the bank does look for workout options.
In this case,
it's just the opposite. You tried when there was the suggestion in bankruptcy that you tried to work this out, you guys took the opposite thing. No, we want to get our judgment on the foreclosure proceeding, and then you get everything.
Your Honor, the foreclosure.
In fact, that's what the jury verdict actually reflected, just the difference between the $8 million that was offered from the third party and what the Lahaina ultimately ended up with. It looks like to me it's exactly the amount of money.
Your Honor, the summary possession action was filed in May of 2000. The bankruptcy wasn't filed until July of 2001. There were repeated efforts by Lahaina Fashions to sell this property. Lahaina Fashions was absolutely refusing to work with any traditional lenders. It was engaged in business with this entity called FICON.
Wasn't there a letter in June that I saw from the prospective buyer? In fact, the person who ended up buying it. So there was a letter that he sent to you folks, and the letter says we're trying to contact the bank, and the bank refuses to make contact with us. I thought that's what I saw in the letter.
Your Honor, there were a number of letters. I believe there was an offer in June of 2000 where a gentleman named Matt Wilson wanted to purchase the property. Lahaina Fashions actually rejected that offer because they thought they could get a higher price by working with this FICON entity. Mr. Wilson came back in the spring of 2001, and the bank did try to allow plaintiff to exercise its option. And in fact, a letter from Mr. Tam stated, we have never refused to allow you to exercise the option, and we will comply with our obligations if you're able to close this deal. However, the bank's beneficiaries, these retirees who invested in the real estate equity fund, are losing out on $40,000 a month of lease rent payments that aren't being made by Lahaina Fashions. They have an absolute fiduciary duty to pursue all of their rights under the lease, whether that is terminating the lease and taking the property back, or forcing payment if Lahaina Fashions were able to pay, but somehow create the cash flow that they had bargained for, and that wasn't happening. And the arrearages here by the end of the day were over $1 million.
I understand, but it looks like to me the jury didn't buy the version of events that you just gave us, because their finding, 675, is exactly the difference, it looks like to me, adding up what they were behind and the difference between of that $8 million offer. So I understand your version of the events, but I'm not sure if it's right with the jury.
Well, certainly, Your Honor, the jury did make its findings. Those findings don't give rise to a fiduciary obligation on the part of the bank. The fact of the matter here is that it was a commercial transaction. It was negotiated at arm's length. It was a commercial option for the resale of a purchase of property. There is no precedent that would support a finding that a commercial option creates a fiduciary duty from either party running to the other party. And if there was a fiduciary duty in this case, it would create huge conflict of interest issues for trustees who, like the Hawaiian Trust Company here, are acting for the benefit of investors or other beneficiaries.
I'm not sure anyone forces you to go into quite this kind of agreement where, as a term of a lease, you agree that the tenant can sell your ownership interest and your leasehold interest unilaterally. That seems so. If you talk about fiduciary, it seems to me you're the folks who agreed to that terms.
You're correct, Your Honor, that we did agree to those terms. And it was not a simple deal. It was a complex commercial transaction. But again, this option, like any other option, requires the holder of the property to release its interest. And in order to provide for that option, the holder gets some sort of consideration. And here we got consideration in the form of increased lease rent and a potential share of the appreciation.
What do you make of the testimony of your representative?
Your Honor, I believe that Mr. Weir was being asked to testify as to the factual underpinnings of the relationship here. My read on his testimony is that basically what he was saying is, yes, there's a duty of good faith. We have a duty to act in good faith towards Lahaina Fashions. And I believe the quote was, you could call it fiduciary. It's a stretch, but I suppose I'll take that. And he went on to testify that that's not really a fiduciary duty under the law.
Is there anything wrong with that testimony?
Well, I, I believe that it would be incorrect to characterize this as a fiduciary duty, but that's not...
Is it inadmissible? I mean, you folks didn't object to it, right?
Again, Your Honor, the question of admissibility here, I suppose, depends on the purpose for which the testimony is being offered. Mr. Weir certainly could testify and would be admissible for him to testify as to the relationships under the agreements. He was involved, he was a fact witness, and we didn't object to that testimony. But now if it's being offered as opinion testimony, whether lay opinion or expert opinion, that's not admissible for the determination on a question of law. And in any event, even if the court were to consider it an opinion, the court would be required to, and did, in fact, consider all of the evidence in the record as a whole and recognize that under the circumstances presented here, regardless of how Mr. Weir might characterize it, there was no fiduciary obligation between these parties.
Can I ask you an impression of Rule 704? It says this: testimony in the form of an opinion or inference, otherwise admissible, is not objectionable because it embraces an ultimate issue to be decided by the trier of fact.
Your Honor, I don't believe that that's necessarily applicable here because the issue was not one to be decided by the trier of fact. The issue is whether a duty existed. So if we're talking about the opinion testimony not being admissible, it's only inadmissible on whether there's a question of law.
It's admissible as to the facts that are surrounding, but perhaps not on the ultimate question of law. But maybe the jury had to decide facts before they were given the law in order to make that determination.
Yes, exactly. Thank you, Your Honor. The jury would need the facts. At the time of Mr. Weir's testimony, the breach of fiduciary duty claim was still in play. It hadn't been dismissed yet. So I suppose we didn't object to that testimony because ultimately the jury was going to need to know those facts to make their factual determination. But that doesn't render the testimony admissible on the question of law as to whether a fiduciary duty existed.
Was he offered as an expert?
No, he was not, and thank you. That was another point I wanted to make. He was never offered as an expert by any side.
So was there any foundation laid for an opinion assuming that you would be able to treat his testimony as expert opinion?
I don't believe that there was an adequate foundation laid. I believe he may have testified in his background that he was a licensed attorney. I don't recall if he was or not, but he was not offered as an expert. And this assertion that he had written a paper on fiduciaries, that was never made at the court below, and there was not question on that, at least not to my recollection.
Is it admissible as a statement against interest?
Your Honor, whether or not it's a statement against interest would go to the hearsay exception, I believe. The argument here is not that it's hearsay, it's that it's not admissible for the purpose of serving as an opinion on a question of law.
Is it an admission of a party opponent?
Again, that would go to getting around the hearsay objection. Which
okay, right. So.
But to answer your question, where I think you're going is whether this would be in the nature of a binding admission.
Right.
Absolutely not, Your Honor. You
but he did testify that he saw your client, the bank, in a fiduciary relationship with Lahaina Fashions?
Not exactly, Your Honor. He testified that they owed contractual duties and a duty of good faith, and if you want to stretch the meaning of the term fiduciary, maybe you could call it a fiduciary relationship. And he went on to testify that his true fiduciary relationship was owed to the investors of the Hawaii Real Estate Equity Fund. And he explained that, yes, I had a duty, the bank, trust had a duty to act in good faith towards Lahaina Fashions. But in terms of a legal fiduciary relationship, which Mr. Weir did use the term big F and little f, the true fiduciary relationship here ran to the investors who were beneficiaries of the REIT fund.
Couldn't you have two fiduciary relationships? I mean, there's unquestionable you had one to the beneficiaries of the trust, but why wouldn't there be a possibility of having dual fiduciary
those
responsibilities if you draw up a lease that creates those fiduciary responsibilities?
If you were to draw up a lease that created fiduciary responsibilities, which in fact would be a trust document, I suppose, as opposed to a lease with an option, then maybe you could create a fiduciary relationship and have two fiduciary responsibilities. However, those responsibilities would be in direct conflict.
But
the trust in an
impossible Hawaiian situation. Trust, or the trusts are often have competing fiduciary interests that they have to deal with. When you, as a trustee, you have, you know, the primary beneficiaries, and we have, you know, residual beneficiaries and competing beneficiaries. it's fairly common for a trustee to have competing, conflicting fiduciary duties to different people in the same transaction.
I don't believe that it would be common for there to be competing fiduciary duties in a situation like this where you've got...
Well, the issue is whether or not, the issue really is whether or not there is a fiduciary relationship, right?
That's right.
And under definition of trust, do you think that this is not a trust? A trust is a fiduciary relationship with respect to property, subjecting the person by whom the property is held, the bank, to equitable duties to deal with a property for the benefit of another person, which arises as a result of a manifestation of an intention to create it. And so doesn't the lease option create at least a question of fact as to whether or not there's a manifestation of an intention to create a equitable duty as to for the bank to deal with the property as to Lahaina Fashions?
Your Honor, there's two points in response to that. The first is that there has to be a manifestation of intention. The second is that manifestation of intent must be for the property to be held for the benefit of another. Here, there was not a single document that stated that the property would be held for the benefit of Lahaina Fashions.
Isn't there a question of fact as to that? As to whether or not the fact that Lahaina Fashions had a 10-year option to sell the property? Isn't there at least a question of fact?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I believe the law...
Well, you had an agreement, right?
Yes.
A written agreement. And I assume the written agreement would express the intentions of the parties. Because if you went outside of that written agreement, you'd have to resort to parole evidence. Is that correct?
That's absolutely
correct. Did anybody raise parole evidence?
I don't believe that the parole evidence rule was raised. The contract here, though...
As you say, in this, what is it called, a lease? Lease with an option? There's no expression that the bank holds for the benefit of Lahaina, is there?
Absolutely not, and just the opposite.
Well, that's pure trust language. If there were a trust relationship established, you would expect to be found in the document.
Not only would you expect it to be found, it absolutely has to be found in the documents. There has to be a manifestation of intent to create that relationship. The documents here, the lease, on the first page
and
of the lease...
And whatever Mr. Weir thought about this document, the question of whether or not this document is sufficient to establish a trust relationship would have to depend on a question of law.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And the judge's role here was to look at the documents that created the relationship between the parties and determine whether there was that manifestation of intent. So the lease, as I was saying, clearly states that the property was to be held for the benefit of the investors of the real estate equity fund. It did not create a trust in favor of Lahaina Fashions.
So there was consideration going to Lahaina, right? Lahaina, I guess, extended, by virtue of the lease, extended its control over the property. Is that right? Did the bank pay off or forgive the debt, some of the debt?
What happened was, Lahaina Fashions was in default on a different loan.
American Savings. Yeah.
International Savings.
International Savings.
The bank provided $6 million as a purchase price for Lahaina Fashions. They used that money in part, I presume, to pay off the pre-existing debt and to take the property out of foreclosure. It was in foreclosure back in 1994. They also received cash in whatever amount was remaining. And in addition to that, under the lease, they had possession of the property itself, and they were able to lease that to their then subtenant, Planet Hollywood, and they were receiving payments from Planet Hollywood that were sufficient not only to pay the $480,000 a year lease rent that was owed to the trust, but to also generate a profit from that relationship. Now, Planet Hollywood went bankrupt in 1999, and that's what started all these issues, but ultimately, the trust, upon the default of Lahaina Fashions, had a right and an obligation to take the acts that it took. Now, none of this gave rise to a fiduciary relationship. see that I'm almost out of time. I would just like to talk very briefly about the jury verdict issue. I think the court very well recognizes that the judge did discharge the jury and went back to speak with the jurors following the trial in this matter.
Once the judge spoke to the jury, it made it virtually impossible for the question to be resubmitted to the jury, didn't it?
Not virtually impossible, absolutely impossible.
By then, the jury knew what was at stake based on the colloquy.
That's right. And if it were an abuse of discretion by Judge Cardoza to refuse to resubmit it after that conversation, it would wreak havoc on our jury system. Judges would probably be afraid to talk to jurors and thank jurors, because if there were a scintilla of evidence of juror remorse, they would feel obligated to either resubmit or correct the verdict form. And that just can't be Hawaii law, and it's not Hawaii law. And in addition to asking...
So I was going to say, even if we don't agree with your definition of discharge, it would appear that... Do you agree that this seems to be a misunderstanding of the question that resulted in the juror's answer in this case?
My read on this is that it was a misunderstanding as to the legal effect of the factual finding that the jurors made. The law here is clear. This is Cabral is directly on point. There's no grounds to correct a verdict based on misunderstanding. But it's whether they misunderstood the question or they misunderstood the legal effect of the question. The juror's testimony under HRE 606B is not admissible for purposes of impeaching the verdict. So the primary point on whether the verdict could have been corrected or not is whether there was a clerical error. Judge Cardoza made a clear express finding of fact that there was no clerical error, and he in fact expressed his belief that the jurors had expressed confusion as to the legal effect of their factual finding. There's substantial evidence in the record to support that finding. And that being the case, there was no error, there was no clerical error, there was no mistake when the verdict was written down. The jurors voted to answer yes, they marked yes on the verdict form, they confirmed that they voted yes when they were polled immediately thereafter. They again confirmed that they had initially voted yes during the August 7th polling. In the absence of a clerical error, there's no grounds for the judge to correct the verdict, and especially where only 6 of 12 jurors expressed the remorse that gave rise to this appeal. On the resubmission point, since I do have a few minutes remaining, I just wanted to point out that the only precedent that has been relied on by Lahaina Fashions and the precedent in the state of Hawaii allows for resubmission only where there is, first, an ambiguity or an inconsistency on the face of the verdict form, and second, where the jury has not been discharged. Here, of course, the jury was discharged, but again, there was no inconsistency on the face of the record. So regardless of the discharge, there, again, was no grounds to resubmit, and certainly not 10 months after the jury had left the courtroom. So at the end of the day, Judge Cardoza went well above and beyond anything that he was required to do to ensure that Lahaina Fashions got a fair shake in this matter. And he went above and beyond in his efforts to make sure that the right result was reached. The judgment here is supported by 200 years of common law tradition, express directives of both the federal and Hawaii rules of evidence.
I just wanted to confirm with you, did the jury send out an inquiry about whether or not they could consider awarding damages even if they felt the statute of limitations had passed?
Yes, Your Honor. And for the court's reference, that can be found at the electronic docket number 63, page 2689. So the jury said exactly as you stated, can we find fault and award damages even if we believe the statute of limitations had passed? So certainly, at least some of the jurors had decided that the statute of limitations had passed. And although we probably shouldn't be talking about the intent of the jurors, it would seem to me that they decided to answer the questions honestly, and some of them may have hoped that it wouldn't result in the statute of limitations bar. That hope is not admissible, and it's not relevant to what the judgment should be in this case. Judge Cardoza entered judgment appropriately on the original verdict as returned by the jury.
Thank you, Mr. Lawton.
Thank you.
Mr. Alioto, 2 minutes to wrap up.
May it please, Your Honor. Whenever the case, Your Honor, in which the judge went to the jury afterwards to congratulate them, found out that there was a misunderstanding and the correction needed, is the McCulloch case and his 1991 case in the Sixth Circuit, and it's 937 Fed Second, 1167.
Mr. Alioto, the McCulloch case, both the Sixth and Seventh Circuits, though, affirmed the judge in exercising his or her discretion in deciding whether or not the jury had been discharged or whether the question can be resubmitted. In this particular instance, the court exercised its discretion in not allowing the verdict to be changed. So insofar as affirming the court's discretion, if we followed those cases, wouldn't we be affirming the court?
No, I don't believe so. And as the court found out, as the court said in the McCulloch, Your Honor, a little different, I think, than what Your Honor just said, but the court found in McCulloch is that it was a correction. It was a correction in the transmission of the verdict rather than impeachment of the verdict. Mm-hmm. So they're just correcting a mistake. And of course, as we know, in Rule 1, which is different than the federal rule, in Hawaii it is shall. They shall be construed to come up with a just interpretation. Shall. In the federal rule, it's should. I will also point out that in this court's case, January of 1989, and again, this is the Manapine case, and again, this is afterwards. This was even criminal. And in this case, of course, it states, as long as the jury remains under the direction of the trial court, it is within the court's province to have them render a correct verdict, and then they can correct the verdict. And Rule 60, and by the way, I do not know what the answer, I didn't remember that being submitted to the jury, Your Honor, but obviously if that question were asked, the answer would have to be no. So then why would they have done it anyway? And just as one of the jurors said, we never would have gone through the violation and the impact and the damages and the punitive aspect if we thought that the statute had run. One of the jurors actually said that. What is the reason and purpose for Rule 60? As part of the Hawaii Rules of Civil Procedure, I mean, it says mistakes and inadvertence, etc. And it says on a motion and upon such terms are just, and it applies to appellate courts, and certainly the Supreme Court may relieve a party from a final judgment or proceeding for the following reasons. Mistake. It recognizes there is a mistake. This is the part that I don't understand at all. Judge Cardoza specifically rescinded his order with regard to the discharge. Specifically, we put it out on page 4 of our brief. And he said he apologized for it. I'm really sorry about it. By the way, no one left the courtroom. No, forget that. No one left the jury room. No one left the jury room. He brought them right back in. Okay, so he rescinded the discharge. Okay, now having rescinded the discharge, then, if you go to this Cabal case, which I think that this court should look at and see whether or not it should be at least distinguished, if not more than that. But if you look at the Cabal case, it begins by saying, therefore, the issue is whether when a jury subsequent to its discharge. So if it's discharged and gone, then you have no reason or an understanding as to what they were saying.
Mr. Alioto, please wrap up.
Great. Thank you very much for the privilege of being able to argue.
Thank you.